This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to Motive and Method. I'm Tim Watson-Munro.
And I'm Dr. Xanthi Mallett.
Today we're going to be speaking about young people at risk of radicalisation. Around 7 p.m. on Monday evening, the 15th of April, a 16-year-old boy allegedly repeatedly stabbed a bishop, Marmari Emmanuel, and at least four churchgoers during a sermon which was being live-streamed at the Christ the Good Shepherd Church in the Sydney suburb of Wakeley. By all accounts, the bishop is a popular, if controversial, figure whose sermons are watched by millions of people online, perhaps making him a target. Video shows a person in a dark hoodie approaching the bishop and raising a weapon. The incident triggered unrest as hundreds of people gathered over the next 5.5 hours outside the church, which resulted in police officers being hospitalised with serious injuries, police cars damaged, and the riot squad was called in. According to AFP News Agency, the Wakeley neighbourhood is a hub for Sydney's small Christian Assyrian community.
The circumstances of this particular incident, I think, give us access to talk about radicalisation of young people. So we're going to keep it general after this, but let's look at this incident specifically and what led to this, potentially led to this attack. So was it the particular church that was targeted in that neighbourhood, the particular bishop in question? And also, we saw a huge spread of videos of the attack and the aftermath online, because literally people, it was obviously being live streamed, the sermon, and then people were also videoing it and videoed what happened. And this went on social media literally immediately after the event. And obviously lots of people saw it happen as well online. And also the existing tensions between the Assyrian Christian and Muslim communities in that particular area. And this was almost a perfect storm for combustibility, especially, I think, in the wake of what happened last Saturday, the stabbing. Everyone is very much on edge. The crowd ultimately wanted retribution against the boy that was allegedly involved, the 16-year-old, and reports suggest that he was actually injured inside the church, and he's one of his fingers was actually amputated inside that church. And again, there's videos circulating online of that. The accused was eventually removed from that location by the police after a number of hours, although it was pretty hairy there for a while with so many people, hundreds of people outside that church trying to get in. Very frightening for the first responders, police and ambulance crews who were in attendance. But he was removed to a secure location under heavy guard and remains there. Obviously, this has left Sydney utterly on edge after the stabbing attack at Bondi Junction Westfield, although obviously there's no intention that the two events are linked.
What do we know about the accused? 16-year-old remains under police guard in hospital. He's evidently known to the police, but it's not on a terror watch list. And allegedly the weapon was a switchblade. He acted alone, but ASIO Director General Mike Burgess said, and I quote, "At the same time, our job is to look at individuals connected with the attacker to assure ourselves that no one else in the community is there with similar intent." The New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns, confirmed on Tuesday that the teenager had been found with a knife at school in 2020, 4 years ago, and was placed on a good behaviour bond over that crime 3 months ago.
He was only 12 at the time. That's frightening.
That's very young. The New South Wales Police Commissioner, Karen Webb, said the attack had a degree of premeditation, and I'm quoting her, "We believe there are elements that are satisfied in terms of religious motivated extremism and of course, the intimidation of the public through that person's acts by attending the church while it was being live streamed, intimidating not only the parishioners in attendance, but those watching online, she said on Tuesday.
A video taken inside the church allegedly shows the teenager calling out in Arabic, and I'm quoting, "If he didn't get himself involved in my religion, if he hadn't spoken about my prophet, I wouldn't have come here. If he had just spoken about his own religion, I wouldn't have come." This again led ASIO to labelling this as an act of terrorism, which is in essence one that is deemed to be religiously or ideologically motivated.
To create fear in others.
Exactly. And we're talking on TikTok. I read that this particular bishop has something like 25 million downloads on TikTok and also a huge Instagram following. So if you think about the number of people who would have been affected by this, it's really quite extreme. You know, now things are being live streamed. So again, that makes me wonder whether this was particularly, you know, chosen for that purpose to affect as many people as possible.
Well, you'd recall the massacre at the Christchurch Mosque in New Zealand.
Absolutely.
He live streamed everything.
Yep.
It went global. And look, we've discussed this many times, the power of social media to get information out there in real time. And arising from this episode, there's two things which spring to mind for me. The first is, of course, people being vicariously traumatized by the event, particularly so close to Bondi Junction, which also was live streamed. There was so much media attention surrounding that particular horror. And this is not long afterwards. It's again being live streamed. I've spoken to people, I don't know about you, people come up to me and say, look, I've seen your interviews. I know what you do. Is it safe to go out now? Is it safe to go to a shopping center? Is it safe to go to church? And of course, my response is, of course it's safe. And you can't let these events dictate your behavior on a day-to-day basis. That's the first point. The second point, of course, is 25 million people. A percentage of those people may be incentivized by this sort of footage. And then you've got the potential for
copycats,
copycat offending and terrorism. That's very troubling. I mean, the whole social media thing, I understand the pros, but there are a lot of cons as well when we look at these sorts of cases.
And I think we have to recognize that Australia is one of the most culturally and linguistically diverse countries in the world, right? We've got more than 100 different faiths or religions, or religious traditions anyway, and 300 languages spoken across the country. But I think the problem is actually when you have such diversity, promoting social cohesion and any kind of breakdown in that can lead to a lack of community resilience. And I think that's what we're seeing at the moment with those levels of fear. A couple of different events very recently, very close together in time and geography, has led to, I think, a wider range of problems and more vicarious trauma across, in essence, the country.
Well, I read an article today, I forget the author and the newspaper, but the gist of it was that Australia's now becoming tribalised. We are, you know, forming little groups based on ethnicity, religious faith, and so on. I don't necessarily agree with that, but certainly the comment was out there. And these sorts of offences where you have one group of people of a certain faith, or one person, to be fair, of a certain faith, attacking a religious leader of another faith for expressing a point of view, it's getting pretty precarious in my view. You've got to wonder how these people become radicalized.
You mean young people specifically?
Young people, how are they becoming radicalized? We can't talk about him, obviously, it's subjective. I've had a number of cases, no names, no pack drill, where young people have been significantly radicalized to the point where they have been charged and convicted of, you know, wanting to blow up buildings, wanting to attack churches and mosques and so on to make a statement. And the sort of golden thread, the common theme with the people I've examined is one of alienation, one of anger, one of being, I think, brainwashed in many ways by social media and some of the things that appear in mainstream media as well. Unemployment, feeling disaffected, wanting to belong to a group who have similar and so on, because of low self-esteem. And these are very difficult dynamics to tackle, but we need to tackle them. And I think, as you know, the Premier has said, others have said, we need to have more resources focused on mental health issues, educational programs. And, you know, Australia, I still believe, is the lucky country, but at the same time, we seem to be spiralling a bit at the moment.
And I think in a lot of these cases, I've been reading up on this, there seem to be some elements that are key kind of threads throughout. So with people who become radicalized, especially young people online, people might expect to see behavioral changes in either in their ideology, they become particularly ideological, their social relations may change, they may become associated with different groups or become very enmeshed in certain groups where these ideologies are espoused, and can then engage in criminal activity to really push their point. I think one of the things that I've seen over and over again is wanting to belong to something. So these people sometimes feel disenfranchised, isolated, and they're desperately seeking something to belong to. And that's what these groups give them, either online or in person, because we're specifically talking about the online danger to young people who are impressionable and vulnerable to these type of ideologies. But also, I think some of it does happen in person. And, you know, that can be a very powerful motivator when encouraging people down these ultimately very dangerous.
Well, I agree with that. And I think the psychological dynamics are not dissimilar to people joining postcode gangs, outlaw motorcycle groups. There's a common theme of wanting to be accepted and wanting to feel that they're part of a group. And of course, there are, or there is strength in numbers. You know, so if you belong to one of these groups, they will look after you and protect you. Doesn't always happen, of course. And then you've got to factor in young minds, impressionable minds. Mm-hmm. Some research suggests that the brain isn't fully developed until somebody's in their early to mid-20s. Mm-hmm. Teenagers are impressionable. They want to be accepted. And often there's an absence of really impulse control and consequential thinking in some of these cases, which can be aggravated by issues like substance use, alcohol, drugs, and adverse peer group dynamics where mm-hmm. people being egged behave in this way.
I think these close personal relationships, when it comes to especially violent extremism, are incredibly important. So often what we've seen is when people are becoming radicalized, they pull away from their normal relationships. They stop undertaking their normal mainstream activities. They remove themselves from their friendship groups that they've been part of, and then can become further radicalized as they're further isolated into these ideological groups. So I think if friends and families are kind of warning to those out there, start to see their, you know, people in their circle, especially young people, you know, expressing these political or ideological views and they're concerned, I think they need to reach out for help at that point, because these young people are incredibly impressionable and influenced by these personal relationships, either online or, you know, those individuals they're engaging with in a face-to-face environment.
Absolutely. And then, of course, my other bugbear in the community is knife crime and the availability of these sorts of weapons. Bondi is a horrible recent example of that. And so is this alleged offence. So we need to be doing more about controlling knives. How do you do it? Of course, every kitchen has many, but it's become almost de rigueur with these people that they carry a knife and they will use a knife. And often they don't fully appreciate, in my view, the immense damage that knife wounds can inflict on people.
Well, we saw this again just yesterday. I think there was a group of young people with knives and machetes, I believe, in a shopping centre.
You know, they're carrying around knives, machetes. I'm getting old now, but when people had differences at that age, it was like fisticuffs behind the toilet block at school. Nobody brought machetes along and solved their problems.
I think that's a different motivation there. That's probably more this kind of postcode crime amongst young people, which we have seen an increase in knife crime and knife carrying amongst young groups, you know, who are in conflict. And, you know, while Saturday, the attacks at Bondi was different, again, the motivation This is different in terms of it is apparently, allegedly, ideologically, religiously motivated, but still we're seeing an increase in knives being used in various situations. And I think the combination of radicalization and access to knives is incredibly dangerous. How could this have been stopped? Are we talking about metal detectors on the doorways of churches? Are we getting towards that more American model where wherever you go, you're actually expecting people to be carrying weapons? I mean, where are we going?
Or schools that have metal detectors when primary school kids are going to school and parents are anxious whether their child will be on the school bus home at the end of the day because of this violence. And I think that's the trajectory we're traveling along.
Oh, God, that's frightening, isn't it? The head of ASIO actually said that he, in that press conference, feared just such an attack as this with a lone offender, somebody who's not on a watch list, who, you know, can ultimately cause a lot of harm in a crowded place with just a switchblade. And I say just a switchblade, I don't mean that in a diminishing way. I mean, these are knives and weapons that are so easily accessible. As you said, we all have, you know, lethal weapons sitting around in our kitchen drawers and garages, you know, these. And so I think this type of incident causes fear because it's so unpredictable and so hard to guard against.
And so impulsive. It's one thing to get angry about a situation and then try to access a firearm. It's not that simple, although some people carry them all the time. But a kitchen knife, anyone can get one, and in a fit of rage, they can go out and create a lot of damage. I've done a lot of interviews over Bondi and now this event. And one of the common questions that has been put to me is, do you think we need to have metal detectors in shopping centres? Now, my view is you don't. I think, you know, that's stepping it up a step too far. And of course, people can go through their metal detectors and then go to David Jones at Bondi Junction or elsewhere and go to their kitchenware centre and pick up a knife anyway. So what is the solution? Is it education, programming?
So how do you, from a psychological point of view, how do you actually disengage somebody from potentially violent extremism? Because obviously we want to do that as soon as possible before they break the law, hurt someone, you know, or hurt themselves, because, you know, they're putting so much at risk at that point, aren't they? So how do we work with especially young people who we've been discussing because they're so vulnerable and in light of what happened at the church in Sydney? How do you de-radicalise them? Is it successful?
Well, there are de-radicalisation programs operating now, but you've got to isolate the individual. You've got to determine the cause of the radicalisation in the first place. I've always been an advocate for prevention rather than cure, early education, early intervention and so on. And look, this is not dissimilar to deprogramming people who are involved with cults. And, you know, many years ago, I spoke with Evelyn Einstein. She was Albert Einstein's granddaughter, family friend, not name dropping, but the relevance of her was that she was running deprogramming courses for kids that had been taken over by the Moonies. And you may remember the Moonies, maybe it was before your time, but this was a cult. It was quite powerful, operating in the US, Australia, and other parts of the world. And kids were being seduced into this cult. They were separated from their parents. All the ties, all the sort of stuff we've also discussed in terms of toxic relationships and coercive control, all those dynamics were occurring. And Evelyn said, you know, the way we deal with this is we get the kid, the child, in a room for days at a time and just break down their belief structure. We break down what's real, what's not real, what's fantasy. And eventually, with quite a number of them, there would be a switch in their brain mm-hmm. and they would come home. Some people won't relinquish their beliefs. And I think it's particularly hard for people to do that when they are caught up in adverse peer group dynamics. There may be a desire to leave the peer group, but as often is the case, that creates a raft of problems for those individuals.
I mean, there are things that friends and family can do that aren't there to help somebody that they think is at risk, pull away from these kind of violent extremist groups, peer groups they may have got involved in. And I think it's really important, and I'd be interested in your take on this. One of the main things seems to be to maintain contact with them, because if you lose contact, you lose any positive influence over them and actually leave them at the mercy of these radicalized groups and influences. And if you have lost contact and they reach out to you, respond. You know, that is an olive branch and that is an opportunity to assist that person. So I would urge families to stay in touch if they are concerned about a family member. And certainly if they believe that family member is at risk of committing a criminal act, a violent act against themselves or somebody else, to raise awareness of their ideological motivation, then to actually report that to authorities.
Well, circling back to the Bondi Junction massacre, right, tragedy, and I watched an interview with his parents. My heart went out to them. You know, they said, we've been struggling with this mental illness for a very long time. He was going well when he was having medication. He was having treatment, and then he felt, for some reason or other, that he was going okay. He relocated to Sydney, and they lost contact with him.
Exactly.
And they were just waiting for the day when he could reach out to them so that they could bring him home. And they had, I think, one message of a positive nature where he was on the beach with a surfboard. And then the next time they saw him was when we all saw that dreadful footage of what was occurring at Bondi Junction. So, of course, kids reach out, welcome them home. Very important.
Yeah, heartbreaking for parents to have seen that and to not been able to intervene and prevent that from happening for everybody's benefit, because that has really rocked so many people, just horrendous event. So, yeah, I would encourage families to help their young people or any member of their family if they feel that they are at risk of causing harm to someone or themselves. And I suppose that's what we kind of wanted to end this episode on, is a call for calm and not retaliation. That was a big issue of the church attack. There was obviously that very emotional and fearful crowd outside the church. And what we don't want to see in Australia, which is generally a united company, what we don't want to see in Australia, which is generally a united country, is to let radicals divide us. These are the acts of individuals. And I think as a country, we can rise above this and support each other in our differences in a positive way and embrace that. So let's not see retaliation if it was one boy's actions. And I'm not diminishing the fact that he's a boy, but he's a young person. And we have to just not let that have a bigger impact than it should.
Well, I agree with that. And it's time for everyone to take a deep breath. Will it happen again? We hope not. But it's reassuring to hear the Premier, the Prime Minister, saying we need to do more to address the issues of mental health in the community.
I saw that on the news this morning. Yeah, absolutely.
Radicalisation. That's very encouraging to have government involved at that level, I think.
So if there's any positives to take out of this, I think it's the way we've come together as a country, especially after the Bondi attacks. If there are improvements in mental health service provision, housing provision for those who are suffering with mental health problems, as we've talked about, and raising awareness of potential ways of de-radicalizing and the vulnerabilities of young people, I think take those messages home. And our hearts go out to the families that have been affected by all of these awful events over the last few days.
That's the wrap. I'm Tim Watson-Munro.
And I'm Dr. Xanthi Mallett. Thank you for listening to another episode of Motive and Method.